When you look at the sport, it has the least subjectivity, the most subjective sport, because it's just a start line, finish line, stopwatch, tape measure. And you see Black people from different parts of the world excelling in different events. That upends this theory that given a level playing field, white people will excel.
All right. So everybody, welcome back to episode 2 of the Black Tea Podcast, the infamous Black Tea Podcast. And today we have an exciting, intriguing, fascinating show tied to the sports world.
I feel like sports is always going to be relevant to issues of race because there's just such a large amount of racialized people in sports and the power dynamics are constantly at play. And of course, like everything else, racism comes into play as well.
Yeah, we are in an unprecedented moment in time and sports does not exist on a separate island. It is not immune to the major shifts in consciousness raising occurring at this time. Now, the theme of accountability is constantly being applied, and racism in sports has definitely come to the forefront. Now, the infrastructure around the business of sports continues to contain gatekeepers and barriers affected by racism, and today we wanted to discuss racism at all levels of the sports world. So I wanted to introduce you to our guest. He goes by the name of Morgan Campbell. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about Morgan before we get into it. Now, Morgan Campbell is a super accomplished journalist based in Toronto. And he had just joined CBC Sports as their first senior contributor after spending 18 standout years at the Toronto Star. In 2004, he won the National Newspaper Award for Long Shots, a serial narrative about a high school basketball team from Scarborough. And then he later created, hosted, and co-produced Sportonomics, a weekly video series examining the business of sport. Morgan also spent his last 2 years at The Star authoring the Sports Prism Initiative, which is a weekly feature covering the intersection of sports, race, business, politics, and culture. Morgan just also happens to be a TEDx lecturer, and his work has been featured in the New York Times, the Literary Review of Canada, and the Best Canadian Sports Writing Anthology. Morgan Campbell, how goes it?
Man, it goes well. It's it's an interesting time in sports and in journalism. Like, I've been lucky enough that the stuff I'm doing is kind of pandemic proof, but yeah, it's every day gives us something else to think and to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. No, these are wild times. And I'm hoping, you know, some journalist, a reporter, editor, you know, is going to properly document the happenings, the day to day, because this is just super unprecedented, you know, as far as in human history and certainly our lifetimes. So here's the thing. You're the father, you know, I check out your socials and you're the father of a lovely 15-month-old daughter. So congratulations.
Thank you.
And you also just happen to be married to world champion hurdler, Perdita Felicien. I got to get that out there.
That is true, too.
Which must be interesting in your household, you know, when there's like a race to get to the fridge to get that last, you know, glass of milk or, but you also played some football at Northwestern University as well.
Yeah, I was on the team for 2 years. The 2 years, they were really good. 95 and 96. Not to date myself, but boom, I dated myself. 25 years ago, I started.
That's right. We is getting old. So as far as the reason I mention you being, you know, married, you're a father, you know, I'm the father of a 14-year-old son. And, you know, and I also used to be a baller back in the day. Shout out Oakwood Collegiate Barons. And I ran track at university. Now, what I notice as a father is that a super large and I guess we'd say disproportionate number of my son's friends who happen to be Black. They all seem to have this idea that they're going to ultimately, you know, go play in the NBA someday. All right. And or it's either that or they're going to become a huge rap star. OK, so now I wanted to ask you, you know, as a father, as a former athlete, as a sports reporter, as somebody married to the most elite level, you know, world champion sprinter. In your opinion, is there a reason that so many, you know, Black kids, Black boys in particular, perhaps feel that they have to carry this dream of, you know, I'm going to play in the NBA, right? When the facts are kind of saying that the more sort of guaranteed, you know, steady money, longevity, it lies in other, you know, like ownership, being a sports lawyer, management, coaching, that type of thing. What's your spin on that?
I'll put it to you like this. Since you mentioned my wife, like she made a good living running, but she also knows that she is one of a very small number of people that actually makes a good living in professional track and field, especially as a woman. So like as our daughter gets older, we're definitely going to encourage her to try a bunch of different sports because there's a good chance she'll have some talent. But no one in this house is going to put any pressure on our daughter to become a professional sprinter because the chances of two people from one family making a good living in that sport where money is so scarce and where 10% of the people make 90% of the money, you know, the chances of two people from one household winding up hitting that lotto number are very slim. So that's not something that you'd bet on. And I think the problem with the way a lot of teenage athletes are socialized, a lot of teenage athletes, a lot of whom the very good ones happen to be Black, are socialized to think that the NBA is a thing everyone can do. When in reality, there's only two rounds in the draft, 30 teams in the league. So there's only 60 new people that get gigs in the NBA basically every year. And so there aren't a lot of ways to make a living playing. And the reality is, like, because you're 16, you think that you're going to go pro because you don't know or recognize the odds stacked against you. And in some ways, that's fine. The question is, what happens when you get to 18, 19, 20? You're in university or you're in college, and it starts to become apparent that the NBA isn't going to happen for you. What other steps are you taking to prepare yourself for life? And you should also have people around you that give you an honest assessment of your chances of one, going pro, and two, making a good living going pro. So then it becomes a question of, do I want to do this forever? Do I just want to get a regular job?
Yeah, and it's and it sort of grows out of, you know, perhaps, you know, when your daughter gets older or, you know, and has a peer group. It's just it's an observation, you know, that I've seen, you know, a 14-year-old son. And, you know, when you're kind of old school, you know, and do like, or think of the, you know, the notorious B.I.G. lyric, you know, where he says, you know, it's either you're slinging crack rock or you've got a wicked jump shot. You know, like, these are the pathways, you know, for a lot of, you know, black youth. And we know that the facts are, you know, the NBA, there's only, you know, 497 jobs, right? There's only 497 players in the that were on NBA roster this last year, you know, so it's just this idea of we are, you know, you may be young people who just happen to be Black are perhaps only told that we can entertain, you know, like every team has doctors, they got lawyers, economists. But yeah, so that's where that comes. The question comes out. Comes from.
Yes, I do, though, push back on the idea that Black people as a group, we don't achieve XYZ because XYZ careers aren't flashy enough for us, because it's the same argument people make about baseball. Why aren't there more Black kids in baseball? Well, baseball is too boring. Baseball is too slow for Black kids. The implication being that, you know, we are not smart enough. Our attention spans aren't long enough to engage in this game meaningfully and follow it through. And the numbers also tell you that the proportion of American-born white players is also going down. So if baseball is too slow and too boring for Black people, it's also too slow and too boring for white people. But these Black people from other countries, and now in the United States, the fact that Black people also live in other countries is going to become a big thing because Kamala Harris is the VP nominee. But these Black guys from Cuba, from Venezuela, from the Dominican Republic, they all play baseball. They're not too bored by, they are very Black. They're Blacker than I am. Vladimir Guerrero Jr., his nickname is El Negro, and there are no layers to meaning to that nickname. That nickname is what it is, and it says what it says, El Negro. So he's Black. Unequivocally, yeah. Unapologetically, and baseball's not too boring for him. So it has nothing to do with boring. So we do have to get away from shaming young Black people for just being young people. And so if you are on the outside, if you're 16 years old watching the NBA, the people you see are the players. You don't see the team doctor. You don't see the accountant. So even a young Black person watching hockey is not going to see a ton of Black people. You're going to see now than you would have seen 25 years ago. But as a young Black person growing up watching hockey, if you play a little bit, you're going to watch and say, I want to be the player. You're not necessarily going to watch and say, I want to be the physiotherapist. I think it's completely natural to look at a performer in the same way people look at singers and say, hey, I want to sing. There's not a ton of people until later on that say, I want to tune pianos or whatever it is.
Yeah. And, you know, and also, I guess, you know, you're also talking about access, and it is easier for, you know, younger people to be just in general. But I feel like a lot of the time when people are talking about Black people, even if it's something that applies to everybody else,
yes,
they get focused on like Black on Black crime. Like, just, these are just like signals of white supremacy, I feel like. So of course you'd have to be careful with that in sports. And that's sort of what I wanted to talk about. You know, sports is supposed to be the great equalizer. It's supposed to be, you know, how high you jump, how well you throw a ball, how fast you run. But I just feel like as an observer, the sports world lives in this constant state of paradox. I mean, there's a disproportionate amount of Black talent and athleticism on display. And you'd think based on numbers alone, a sense of equality would prevail. But then when you hear accounts of racism anywhere from the court, the field, coaching, management, now we're hearing a lot about people that cover sports. I know you've written about it. Donovan Bennett has been pretty outspoken, as well as Kayla Gray here. But then, you know, from the fans' perspective and from what I, when I hear people pushing back, it's almost like that's a betrayal to the colorblindness and the meritocracy that sports is supposed to be based on. But if we're talking about systems that don't work, isn't meritocracy one of them? Does meritocracy really exist if people are pretending that they don't have bias in the first place?
Well, I will plug my TEDx talk, because I discuss this in my TEDx talk, the idea of sports as a meritocracy.
Please do.
Right, and how Black athletic success really confuses and confounds and trips up this white supremacist way of thinking, right? Because mm-hmm. white supremacy says in a meritocracy, because white people are better, white people are going to get ahead if you give everyone a level playing field, right? Which is why, again, like in the corporate world, when we say, your workplace needs to be more diverse. You need to hire more people of color. And then the white people say, we got to hire the best person available. So if we diversify, we won't be able to hire the best person available. The assumption being that the white guys already there are the best people right. available. And that you'll get more talent from a shallower talent pool than you will from a deeper talent pool, which is ridiculous. But this is what white supremacy right. says.
But that, I mean, that goes from the assumption that their assessments are accurate in the first place. Because, like, thinking like that means that you don't think you should be analyzed.
Exactly. And so now when you take it to sports, when, like, so many of the subjective measures are especially in sports like track and field, where you have the fewest number of subjective measures, it's all it's about is who runs the fastest, who jumps the highest. That's it. When you look at the sport that has the least subjectivity, the most subjective sport, because it's just a start line, finish line, stopwatch, tape measure. And you see Black people from different parts of the world excelling in different events. That upends this theory that given a level playing field, white people will excel. Which is why you start getting all of these white people obsessed with what makes these different types of Black people run so fast. Why did Jamaicans sprint so fast? Why do Black Americans sprint so fast? Why do Kenyans run so well in the marathon? Why do Ethiopians run so well in the marathon? What's the next group of East Africans that we can herd into these races to do well in the marathon to make money for white agents and white shoe companies, right? Yeah. And this is also where we get the idea to understand that, like, right now, you know, there's this idea that athletic ability and brains, if you cannot have a lot of both of these attributes. So if you're really athletic, you got to be dumb.
Still?
Right, but no one ever, listen, that way of thinking didn't gain traction until Black people started excelling in sports, until Black people started. Like, if you read old accounts of, like, boxing matches, and before boxing was integrated on a large scale, the perception, the stereotypes about Black people before Jack Johnson, leading up to Jack Johnson, was that Black people were too weak and too dumb to be in sports like boxing, right? So the stereotype went from Black people are weak and feeble and unable to excel in anything without the institution of slavery to keep them in line, to Black people are these selectively bred superheroes that are put on this planet to dominate sports.
But these are all stereotypes that, you know, talk about how Black people need to be controlled.
Absolutely.
Even to justify Black people being better at something, the fact that that reasoning quickly needs to turn it on its head.
Yes. And rather than just, like, evaluate people as individuals, as human beings, and appreciate what they've achieved, right? You have to find some way to explain it through, in the laboratory or through pseudoscience. Instead of just saying, hey, that guy's really good, I should appreciate it.
Thank you for that. And we're going to be back after a quick message.
Yeah. So, Morgan, you know what's interesting? I spend a disproportionate amount of my broadcast watching time, like, you know, tuning into U.S. sports coverage. All right. Real talk. Now, am I a bad Canadian or an unpatriotic Canadian? I don't think so. You know, what's been a real sore spot for me is First, you know, there's a qualitative element to my analysis, for one. So you can read between the lines on that. You know, with all due respect to many of the sports broadcasters working here, it's just a better product. For the most part, American sports coverage, basketball, football, it goes on and on. Now, in Canada, you know, where you've been based, you've been working as a, you know, print reporter, broadcaster, online. I find that, you know, in Canada, it seems to me that we tend to have, you know, most of our sports talk shows and sports coverage, you know, you look at the lead anchors and what you see, what you've been seeing for the last number of decades is a sort of, you know, dual white guy setup, or you have, you know, two anchors, perhaps it's one white guy, one white woman, or you have this mostly solo white male anchor thing. And then perhaps if you're lucky on an off day, you'll have, you know, one black ex-athlete as a pundit on the side. This is what I've seen. These are real facts. It's not open to debate. I've been watching sports forever. I'm a, you know, former athlete. So the question I had for you is, you know, where does this setup where I'm just seeing the white guy lead anchor, the two dual white guy co-anchors, where does that setup leave black reporters? You know, like you have a bunch of, you know, black men and women who had, you know, some had gone to J school, you know, maybe Carleton in Ottawa, Ryerson, other journalism schools. Yourself, you went to school in the States. And some of these black reporters, you know, aren't necessarily, they may be black, but they may not even be ex-athletes. They're just really good reporters who happen to be black and want to get into sports journalism. So can you sort of give me your analysis on that over the years, you having been at this for the last couple decades? And this is what you've seen. This is what I've seen. And it's just frustrating as a viewer. But I want to get, you know, your perspective on all this.
Part of the problem is that there's a really tight bottleneck to get those jobs in the first place. And then if you're black, the bottleneck is even tighter because the decision makers are so biased towards black ex-athletes at the exclusion of everyone else. And so for a lot of black people trying to get on the air, they face this weird situation where a prerequisite to getting on the air is having played professionally. And as tight as the bottleneck is to get on the air, it's a tighter bottleneck to get into the NFL or the NBA. But this is the prerequisite, mm-hmm. right? And, yeah. and we have been lucky here in Toronto that Sherman Hamilton exists, right? And that he was around and on the scene in the early years of the Raptors. Maybe not right when they started, but when they started becoming an important TV property. Because he's a guy that played, I remember him from Peel Region back in the day. He was a couple years older than me. He was playing high school ball up in Malton. He was a star. And then he went to Virginia Commonwealth, came back here, and now he's a part of Raptors broadcast. Like, if he wasn't around right now, if he wasn't already here, if they were trying to start a broadcast, it'd be very difficult for a guy like him who had not played in the NBA to get that job. What you have is, again, like this almost impossible prerequisite that most of the white guys with microphones don't have to satisfy. And they're really good at their jobs and never played pro, and that's not necessarily something you would expect from them. And they don't have to have played pro for you to sit down and listen to what they have to say. But for black people trying to get similar jobs, that seems to be the prerequisite. In a lot of cases, it is the prerequisite. And it just makes, you know, an uphill climb even steeper for black people trying to get into the industry. And the other problem we have, and this isn't just in print, this is on TV and in print, many of the big shops, we'll see what changes now at, you know, on the backside of this reckoning on race that we've all been living through the last 3 months. But, you know, in my experience in the industry is that, you know, the decision makers for the most part see the non-white people as in competition and interchangeable with each other. And so when Hal Johnson from Body Break, when he made that YouTube video outlining his experience trying to get hired at TSN, he said, he mentioned going up there and having an interview, and I started doing the math on the years. And before he even got to the punchline, I thought to myself, that was when Mark Jones was at TSN, and I bet what they're going to say is that we already have Mark Jones, so we don't need Hal Johnson. And when Hal Johnson got to the punchline, that was what it was. And so I'm not sure how much changed between then and this year, but maybe things will change or will have changed over the last 3 months with all these big shops reevaluating how they value black talent and other journalists of color.
It's just so fascinating to me because it's literally an industry that is sustained by a lot of Black talent.
Yes.
But again, this is, it's just like the mundaneness of racism, you know? But I kind of wanted to talk about politics because Kelly Loeffler has been in the news. She's part owner of the WNBA team, The Dream, and she's been calling for the depoliticizing of sports and behaving like the opposite of that. She's essentially a disgraced Trump-supporting senator. She's also had her own separate scandals unrelated to this. And recently, the WNBA Atlanta Dream team, along with Phoenix Mercury and Chicago Sky, showed up wearing t-shirts supporting her rival, Raphael Warnock, a Democrat running against her. And the NBA has absolutely been outspoken on social justice issues before. Is it the role of players to really be speaking out against this? Is this the trend we're moving in forward, them standing up to ownership, coaches?
What fascinated me about the WNBA was that a Trump-supporting senator from Georgia would wind up the co-owner of a WNBA team in the first
place.
Yeah,
I found that interesting, too.
Right. Only because, like, political people on that end of the U.S. political spectrum are also, like, super into very traditional gender roles. So a lot of them don't think women should play sports in the first place. And they find out some of these players are homosexual. They don't like that either. Yeah, here she is jumping straight into this league. So that was the first surprise. The fact that she owned the team is more surprising than the fact that she used the team of the league, of which she is a part of the ownership class, to try to score political points in her Senate race. Because that's right. All.
And when she said, you know, the truth is we need less, not more politics in sports in a time where polarizing politics is as divisive as ever, I feel like it's just... like, are we ever going to get to a point where Black issues are going to be seen, like, centered in sports without this just this nagging argument that she's trying to make, where she's using politics as a tool and then trying to depoliticize it?
So a couple of things. One is that American conservative politicians don't want politics in sports unless those politics agree with their politics, and then it's fine. Right? Because when Tom Brady had the MAGA hat in his locker, people had questions and conservatives said, well, he's allowed to wear what he wants to wear. He's got his First Amendment right to do this. But then when Black athletes say, hey, league, hey, employers, these issues are important to us, so they better be important to you, too. Then all of a sudden it's keep politics out of sports. And that's leaving aside the fact that, again, so many of these issues that are important, and we're talking about the United States and Canada, too, to Black people, where you're talking about creating a world where racism is absent, right? Creating a world where everyone has equal access to opportunity, education, equal treatment, by law enforcement and in the courts. These issues are not inherently political, but one side of the political spectrum in the U.S. insists on politicizing and making debates of all these issues that are really just about fundamental human rights and decency. So the other thing that happens with really conservative American politicians when it comes to sports is they become arch socialists in reaction to any motion towards high-profile athletes, especially the Black ones that make college football and college basketball so lucrative, any action towards them getting paid. So last year, when there was motion on this idea that athletes could profit from their name, image, and likeness, in other words, go out and get endorsements, then here come Republican senators saying, well, they need to pay taxes on the money that they make from these endorsements. Any other time, when else have you heard U.S. Republican senators, Republican congressmen and women argue for more taxes? When Black athletes want to get paid, now here they come saying, you need to pay taxes on this money, which shows you that they don't think of taxes as taxes per se or as a way to fund the government, but as a punishment on poor people for being poor. And what they are conservative about really are your rights and freedoms, right? As a Black college athlete in a revenue sport, they're very conservative. They want you to operate in a very narrow lane, but they want all kinds of leeway for everyone else.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah, no, totally. That's a great segue. I mean, even in this year in sports, Morgan, I mean, it's going to be an interesting year. Yeah. Because, you know, we see that, you know, when large NCAA conferences, you know, pro sports, like they're canceling their seasons outright. Like you see that in football, different conferences. You know it's a problem, you know what I mean? Because of the big business behind these decisions. Like this is losing, these schools are losing hundreds of millions of dollars making these decisions. Now here's the thing, when you take a look at the devastating impacts of COVID-19 on society at large, and then you take a look at the stats and you see that a hugely disproportionate amount of Black people are being affected by COVID-19, right? For a plethora of reasons. That's even more disturbing, right? It almost feels like lambs to the slaughter. You know what I mean? So here's the thing. You even, you know, you wrote an interesting op-ed, a number of weeks ago about the, you know, and the headline was, you know, rich white coaches want football in a pandemic, but unpaid Black players are most at risk. All right. So can you sort of dig a little deeper into this, that idea around, because in Toronto where we're based and in Canada and most places, you know, North America, you know, kids, they want to get, you know, their 4 years covered, you know, scholarship, cover my 4 years, I'll play football, basketball, doesn't matter what it is, right? So I want you to talk about this idea of, yeah, unpaid labor of Black athletes, and it's sort of fueling the entire college sports economy, you know, and also maybe for you to kind of predict or project, where will we be 3 years from now? You know, are kids going to start getting paid when they play NCAA, like get paychecks, per diems? What's happening there? What's your take?
So I'll answer the first question first, like in the context of the Big Ten Conference postponing fall sports and the Pac-10 Conference postponing fall sports. And it's interesting, but very typical and predictable that football gets all the headlines and gets all the attention. And everyone says, well, what are we going to do without football? These poor football players don't get a chance to play, even though volleyball, cross country, soccer, field hockey, they're not going to get to play either. They're fall sports. If all of the sadness and the hand-wringing and the regret over lost opportunity has to do with student athletes, then why are we not directing any of this to people in sports that don't make money? And the answer is obvious, because this isn't about opportunities lost for the students. This isn't about the students' life on campus being upended and them missing opportunities they can never get back. This is about third parties that want to make a lot of money and feel that the only way they can make money is for these unpaid athletes to go play football and take even more of a physical risk because there's this virus floating around. So it's always about money. So let's not pretend it's about anything other than money. Where this ties into race is that Black Americans are maybe 12% of the population at large, but half of the people playing Division I college football. And then at the higher level programs, basically the better your program is, the more Black guys you have. And so now you have guys who, because they come from a segregated country, so often come from communities that are hardest hit by COVID-19. Now, if the school said to them, hey, look, we want to do you guys a favor because we care about you as young men and women. Come back to campus. We're going to test you. And there's no quid pro quo, because this is the argument they're making. They got to come here and play football because this is where they can get tested and this is where they can get care. But if you're in the middle of a pandemic, like you can bring people back to campus if it's that important and test them anyway without asking them to repay you by going back out and exposing themselves potentially to the virus. Right. If it's really about taking care of these people, then that's what you could do. But again, this whole operation is about trying to protect as many paychecks for as many people as possible, except for the players. So if they really want to have a season, you know, these college football teams could drop the facade of amateurism, do what the NBA is doing and say, hey, let's stake out some ground. Let's have a bubble. Let's have 10 teams in a bubble and play. The flip side, the trade off is that the kids are off of campus now. And they're not really going to class. But if we think this is professional football, then this is what we do. But if we think this is amateur football and the academic component of it is important, then we got to listen to what the university presidents say. And the university presidents say, we're not playing sports this fall. And that's what it is. And again, when you look at the complaints about the postponement of college football, they all come from the same end of the U.S. political spectrum, right? And none of this is a coincidence. It's amazing and disappointing, but not surprising to see this many people or pretend to advocate for the players' right to play when what they really want is entertainment. Because one of the things that has also popped up, one, players from the Pac-10 out in California, Colorado, like that, started this movement saying, we want a union, essentially. We want a players' association. We're not going to play unless, one, you schools can safeguard our health, but two, unless you guys start paying us. Like, we want a revenue split. So when that happens, like the college football gatekeepers are like, well, we don't care what you guys say. College football is college football. Doesn't matter what the players say. But now that these seasons have been postponed and there are players saying, we want to play, we'll sign a waiver. We'll sign a liability waiver to go play. The same people that normally tell the players, shut up and go play, are saying, hey, we need to listen to what these players want. But when the players said they wanted to get paid, we didn't need to listen to what they wanted. And that's even before we get to the fact that, like, you can't push a waiver in front of an 18-year-old, 19-year-old kid who's not allowed to have a lawyer or an agent, right? And have him sign that waiver and then take that waiver to court and say, don't worry, this is valid. So if this kid dies of COVID-19 while under our supervision, he can't sue and his family can't sue. And that's also regardless of the fact that, like, for medical issues, schools stop people from playing all the time. If I'm a football player and I have like a spinal stenosis, and so I can't really go tackle people, or I can, but
that's right.
At some point I'm going to paralyze myself, the team will stop me from playing. And I cannot say to the university, I'll sign a waiver if you let me play with the spinal stenosis. They'll say no. Waiver or no waiver, you're not playing. And that's what happens. And so this is what has happened on a large scale. And, you know, half of the country can't take it. And then the other half of the country says, that's fine, I'll wait till spring. So now where this goes in the future, I'm not sure. What I find interesting is that when these big conferences started trying to make plans to have a fall football season, and then there was the first wave of players that said, we're organizing sort of like a union and we would like a union because we want to get paid alongside all these assurances that you're going to safeguard our health. You know, that was a big step. And then came this counter movement of, we want to play, guys, and we'll sign a waiver just for the right to play. You don't need to give us any extra perks. Those voices got amplified as if that attitude was something new. When the reality is, 30 years ago, you'd have seen a lot more guys like the let us play dudes than you would have seen like the you need to pay us dudes. Right?
Right.
Like when I was in university, we were playing ball. We were playing against good, like I was sitting on the bench, we were playing against really good teams. And like all these name brand schools you see on TV, that's who we were playing against. And it never occurred to any of us like to get a paycheck.
Right.
It never occurred to anyone that we should be getting paid. Yeah. That we should be getting merchandising money or anything like that. That's not where the conversation was back then. Like there was an idea that this thing was a big business, but no one ever said, hey, put all these guys on salary. Hey, let these guys make their own shoe deals. But that's what the conversation is now. So it's not a question of the let us play guys rising up like this wave and overwhelming the we want our rights guys. The reality is that we want our rights guys are a lot more numerous and more vocal than they've ever been.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, because when I started reading some of the works from Dr. Harry Edwards, American sociologist, civil rights activist, who people know from, you know, 1968 Olympics, and Cal Berkeley, and he was always sort of intimating, not so much spelling out, you know, like getting paid, but just kind of this idea of like, hey, are we just going to remain out on what he considered like, you know, out on the playing fields, on the, you know, the modern day plantation, you know, and what's going on the back end, you know, as far as my livelihood, and, you know, like, it can't be just that, you know, out there to happy to be there on playing fields, you know?
Yeah, absolutely, and this is the other wild attitude among fans that, and among administrators too, that COVID has revealed, right, is this idea that players, good players, literally should play for next to nothing. Because they've already said money's off the table, you're not getting money. And so now here comes this pandemic and the players say we need extra layers of safety. And the teams say, maybe. We'll do what we can. Right. But you guys have to accept that you're going to get sick and some of you are going to die. But so now we've gone from.
Yeah.
So you guys are making millions and I might die.
Yeah.
Right. How is this?
You'll notice that. Morgan, you'll notice I said it feels like lambs to the slaughter. Yeah. Honestly, like that's.
You know, a 19th century coal mine, which is not what they were telling us this was even last year.
No.
Even last year it was, hey, you're not getting paid, but you get a chance to get a free ride, go to school, graduate debt-free, enjoy all the aspects of campus life at these great universities. And now it's, be happy, you might die, but still be happy. Either way, bring me my money.
Big facts.
Morgan, I thank you so much for sharing this, your enormous amount of knowledge with us. We really appreciate it.
Anytime, guys.
Okay, so now this is our tea segment, and we're going to be talking about the reaction to Cardi B's song WAP featuring Meg Thee Stallion, which stands for Wet Ass. And I thought the song was an anthem for black female sexual power, and other people felt differently. And people had a lot to say, specifically men.
Yeah, men, but like, you know what? Hey, I'm a guy. I don't qualify to critique what they're saying and doing in the song and video, right? I'm a guy. Who cares what these guys think? Who cares?
I know. And honestly, it really wasn't like, I wish that it didn't get as much press. I wish more press was dedicated to protecting black women, specifically Meg Thee Stallion, who recently got shot. And she even said she was unprotected in that moment. But this is where we are in hip hop. Lyrics are still being analyzed this way. Women's sexuality is still being questioned. And I don't even like Cardi B that much. The fact that I have to defend her, I'm just like, oh, God. I know you like
her. And I'm actually a Cardi B fan.
You're a fan?
But I'm probably not defending her, right? So, hey, this is going to be a great... this is going to be a good one.
Okay, so first we had the viral response of Ben Shapiro, a conservative pundit, where he kind of went over the lyrics in a really funny way.
Here are some of the lyrics. You ready? Whores in this house. There's some whores in this house. There's some whores in this house. There's some whores in this house. Hold up. I said certified freak 7 days a week. Wet ass P word. Make that game weak. Yeah, you effing with some wet ass P word. P word is female genitalia. Bring a bucket and a mop for this wet ass.
Do you watch Atlanta? It kind of reminded me of that episode where that mother was talking about Paperboy's lyrics and horror.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah, the extremely out of touch. Don't have your finger on the pulse of culture. Just that, you know, not black, you know, and just clueless, you know, just out to lunch.
Right. And so he's like, you know, it's extremely vulgar. He's totally like, you know, talking about how vulgar it is. But then something that he said that I thought really stood out was interesting is he said, this is what the feminist movement was all about. Obviously, he's being sarcastic. He says it's not really about women being treated as independent, full-rounded human beings. It's a wet-ass P-word. And if you say anything differently, it's because you're misogynist. But isn't that what being independent and full-round means? Doesn't that mean we should be able to do whatever we want?
Oh, 100%. I mean, okay, just coming from like a male perspective, I mean, also too, you know, I'd worked in the hip hop industry and still do, you know, for the last forever. And, you know, Mel, there are literally hundreds, if not thousands of rap songs where male rappers are explaining to you like in explicit detail, like, you know, that they're a freak and why they're a freak and where they like to freak. Like, this is not even
right.
This
how
is
they're
lightweight.
Gonna use it, and who are they having sex with? I feel like it's all about the agency. And now these women that these rappers have been talking about, like even the DMX Snoop Dogg, that amazing versus challenge.
Yes.
It was kind of uncomfortable in this day and age because I was like, wow, these men really hate women. We were celebrating it.
No, this is it. I mean, how about we take a look at it from, you know, we live in a capitalist society, Mel, and it's just like from a pure capitalism point of view, you know, sex sells, okay? Sex will always outsell everything else, right? Rightly or wrongly, okay? And the thing is here, you know, again, I can, without even blinking, I can list off hundreds of rappers, you know, like male rappers have been doing what Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion, they've been doing that since Jesus, you know what I mean? And making a ton of money doing it. So I would say that Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion, they're just very business savvy rappers. That's what I would say.
Right. But this is what Jermaine Dupri in last year called stripper culture. He said, you know, it's not really about the way people can rap now. It's about strippers rapping. But I feel like it's like, you know, we've had, you know, the video hoe and expressing that type of agency when these women were just in videos. And then we had Corinne Steffens come out and say, no, I actually do this. I actually enjoy doing this. And then with this whole stripper culture emerging, who brought the stripper culture into hip hop? Men. But now it's that the women are allowed to make the rules, do what they want, say what they want, and men aren't involved. I think a lot of people are also reactive of the fact there's not one man in this video, because I think it would be different if one of them was featured on a rapper's song.
Yeah, totally.
But it's always about, you know, is it too sexual? Is it like, why are black women always seen as the people who are holding the community back?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's not fair. Like, I think, I'll say this. I mean, I think as someone like myself, you know, who's represented, you know, I've represented female rappers and singers as a, you know, as a publicist, all right? And I would say, you know, to keep it, I guess, as far as balance, like it would be also nice, like if our community, like meaning the, you know, the hip hop community, the Black community, the racialized community, like if we kind of were to show a little bit more enthusiasm for there's so many great female rappers who, you know, like who, like basically female rappers would tell me as their publicist that they feel that if they don't show some TNA and talk about, you know what I'm saying? And like aren't over sexualized, like they're going to get virtually ignored. And that's pretty much what happens. You know what I mean? So it would be just some balance.
So you mean like conscious rap?
Well, yeah, conscious rap. It would be great if we could get a little bit excited about, you know, female rappers who aren't like just wicked lyrics about other things too, because they get virtually ignored. You know, like there's this rapper out of the UK, Little Sims out of the UK. Like, she's incredible. I don't think anybody knows or cares about her. Mumu Fresh. Like, I could just list off so many, you know, like female rappers. They're not doing the Cardi B thing, and they've been virtually ignored. So I think as a rap purist, you know, I would say that, yeah, the balance is good. Like, you know, what Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion are doing. I mean, I grew up, it's like, you know, they're an extension of like, you know, Foxy Brown, Little Kim, you know, this is not a new thing. This is nothing new going on here, you know? But yeah, the balance would be great if, you know, a lot of Black men and women were to support like Black female rappers that aren't doing the Cardi B thing, is what I would say.
Well, yeah, even Cardi B has spoken on it. She said, you know, she doesn't get as much of a response when she, like, when, for example, when she did Be Careful. She said, first of all, I rap about because she's my best friend and because that's what people want to hear. And she even shouted out a bunch of rappers and said, y'all don't be supporting them and they're mad dope. Bloggers don't support them. They don't get the recognition. So again, this goes back to the notion of sex selling. But do rappers ever stop talking about sex? Like, why are women always held to this standard?
No, they shouldn't be. Because again, the men, they've been cranking out, you know, Two Live Crew, like, it's, you know, since the beginning of time. You know what I mean? And or here's the thing, Mel. I mean, like, me personally, I sit more on the kind of what you dubbed kind of like the conscious rap, you know, like rapping about political issues, social issues. Like, so, you know, I like my Kendrick Lamar's, J. Cole's, that kind of thing.
They also talk about sex, too, though.
100% they do.
Anytime they about, want.
Yes, they do. Yeah. Tupac, it's the reason Tupac was celebrated widely. He talks about sex. He talks about political consciousness. He talks, you know, the things that make us human. You know, we're not kind of like this, I'm a conscious person. That's all I do. I have no desire to engage in, you know, sexual relations. Like, that's not it. Right.
Right.
But the song itself, I mean, you know, do I personally find the song itself to be that deep? Me personally, no. But is it an important song? I would say absolutely. You know, is it a great song from a hip hop kind of, me being more like a rap purist? I'm like, not really. I don't think I'd be talking about this song. You know what I mean? If not for the shock value, the video, I don't think we'd be talking about it as much based on, like, you know, so that's my take, you know? Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because CeeLo, who, I mean, he's not perfect himself on a personal level, but he did an interview and he actually ended up apologizing a couple of days ago because he said, you know, a lot of music today is unfortunate, disappointing on a personal and moral level. There was a time when we were savvy enough to code certain things. We could express to those what it meant with a style of language we use, but now music is shameless. And then he cites Nicki Minaj. And he says that she misuses her success and visibility. It says she could be effective in many constructive ways, but it feels desperate and attention is a drug and competition is around. And then he talks about Cardi B and Meg Thee Stallion. What really got me is that he said, I get it, the independent woman and being in control, the divine femininity and sexual expression, but it comes at what cost? Like, what does that mean? Because I feel like there still are people that feel this way, especially about Black women.
Yeah, no,
like,
totally.
Like that we're losing something by having this other dimension to us.
Yeah, no, I would say no, you women are gaining something. You know, you talked earlier on, you know, just about this idea of sexual agency. Like, it's so incredibly dumb and like backwards, you know, for like a man in 2020 or any time for that matter, right? To feel you know, entitled enough to talk about whether a woman's project, you know what I mean, is like empowering for women. That's just, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, like, women talking about themselves, but they can talk about women all they want. I just feel like it's all about agency and who's in control. It, like, it's about the fact that men aren't involved. Like, these women are talking about being sexual. They perhaps they're talking about, you know, the male gaze in terms of that's how they like in terms of the sexuality they feel in that moment, but they don't really need men to put through that message.
That's right, and it's pissing men off. Or who made you know, how did CeeLo Green become like the moral barometer? You know, like of all that's good and right in hip hop. Like it's just like, I mean, he has some, you know, skeletons, and there's it's just ridiculous. Yeah, it's hard to read that. It's tough. It's tough to stomach reading CeeLo Green sort of weighing and opining on, you know, on say, Megan Thee Stallion, Cardi B. It's really weird reading that.
Thank you so much for listening. We also want to thank our guest this week, Morgan Campbell. And you can reach us both on social media, me at Melena Williams on Twitter or The Only Melly on Instagram, and Dalton Higgins 5 on everything. We also want to thank our producer, Ryan Clark. We'll see you next week.